Hello and welcome to the ORI Spotlight Podcast. We're talking to leaders across the cell and gene therapy industry and telling you more about ORI's mission to manufacture brighter futures. I'm Jason Foster, the CEO of ORI Biotech, and I'll be your host for today's podcast.
Hello and welcome to the ORI Spotlight Podcast. This is your host, Jason Foster. With me today is Matthew Durdy, the CEO of the Cell and Gene Therapy Catapult here in the UK. Welcome, Matthew.
Hi, Jason. Thank you for inviting me.
It's great to be with you. Thanks for coming on. I think a lot of people in our audience will certainly be familiar with the Catapult and love to dive a little bit more into the role of the organization and the history. But first, we'd like to start a little bit with your history and how you ended up as the CEO of the Catapult and your experience as it relates to cell and gene therapy leading up to this role.
Sure. I'm a bit of a mix, but I think it makes sense, or certainly does to me. I'm a biologist by training. Out of Oxford, went straight into investment banking, as most of my cohort did. Got some fantastic experience there in terms of financial training, but also investment training and business development training. And then 20 years ago now, brought the two together in a biotech company, which I was parachuted into to rescue, and realized I was in my comfortable space. And I've been there for about
you found home
20 years on various turnarounds and sales of companies.
Awesome.
And then 10 years ago, I was approached by the UK's innovation agency, Innovate UK, to help them with setting up a new kind of institution. And what should have been a short-term assignment is still ongoing.
Some of those temporary assignments tend to take on a life of their own. Fantastic. That's a real mix of experience going from investment banking into industry, and can't wait to talk a little bit more about that and how it plays into your current role at the Catapult. But tell us a bit more about the Catapult, if you will. Obviously, it's a stalwart in the industry here in the UK, but maybe everyone globally isn't quite aware of it as we are.
The Catapult's as a general concept, is a new kind of institution. It was set up by the UK government as part of a program. So there are nine catapults today in different technology areas, but this one is in cell and gene therapy. And our role is to help the industry develop. And it's very much part of the philosophy that the industry can't develop because it's emerging from research without the development of the research base as well. And we are the glue that sits between the emergent technologies from the research base, which I think we'll probably talk about a bit more, and the industry, which is our role to develop.
Yes. And there's several components to the Catapult and which people should be aware of. So obviously there's the manufacturing center in Stevenage. There's centers of excellence also dotted around. Tell us a little bit about the kind of structure of the organization and maybe some of the partners that you work with, the kind of maybe the types of partners that are most commonly working with you.
So the philosophical approach is that we need to be able to do the things that industry or research won't do by themselves without some degree of intervention or involvement. Because if the industry will do it, the industry should do it.
Yes.
But we cover the whole range of different activities within the scope of cell and gene therapy. So we have people who are non-clinical experts. We have people who are product design experts. We have people who are healthcare experts. Everything that a company might need, they may not need all of it, but everything that a company might need to go from emergent research through to commercial supply. And so that builds on to manufacturing. You know, obviously in our industry, in cell and gene therapy, manufacturing is a big issue. And there's a hell of a lot of learning to be done there. And we're part of that process. And then we have some very large scale manufacturing assets. You referred to the Stevenage facility, where we work in collaboration with companies to help them develop their middle stage manufacturing. I would describe it as the clinical development all the way through to commercial supply. And we also have a facility in Braintree where we work with companies on large-scale manufacturing challenges.
Right. And that Braintree facility is relatively new, do I recall?
It's yeah, we've had it for a couple of years now. We've been doing some refurbishment work on it, but it's now up and running and producing its first technologies, if you like. You asked me about the kind of companies we work with. Actually, it's across the board. So it goes everything from early stage, not yet companies. So what we call commercialization of research, ideas in the research base where they need to have access to partners who can help them understand what the commercialization process is, all the way through to the major pharmaceutical companies who work with us in the manufacturing facilities.
Right. And I'm aware of a couple US-based companies that have kind of set down a footprint, I think, kind of initially alongside the Catapult or at the facilities. Is that also part of the intent to have it be a way to attract global companies into the UK ecosystem?
What we set out to do originally was to say, if you're going to have an industry, you need critical mass. Mm. And a large chunk of that growth is going to come from the UK. But why should it be exclusive to the UK? And let's create an environment which is the best environment for people to develop their new products in. So inevitably, we've attracted in companies from all over the world, actually, from Europe and from the US, who've said, actually, if we're going to go into the space, let's do it in the UK.
Makes sense. And I know a couple of Ori's partners have partnered with the Catapult as well. So I know that our companies, are sort of Ori and the Catapult, share a mission in really trying to improve patient access and get, you know, democratize the ability for patients to access these incredible therapies. I mean, we've proven beyond a doubt, I think, as we sort of enter this 10-year longitudinal data that we're starting to see published from some of the early research institutions like Penn, that, you know, we have incredible clinical efficacy and incredible clinical data to support this industry. The major challenges have really been about, you know, cost of goods and accessibility and, you know, the ability to supply at scale. And I wonder, you know, as you work with companies, as you think about these challenges in the UK context, you know, what do you see? Where am I right in that, you know, supposition? Is that, would that be your summary as well? Where do you see the major challenges facing the industry, and how might the Catapult be trying to help address some of those things?
So we tend to look at the challenges because our operating model is to seek out the challenges of today. And the challenges of tomorrow, which is part of our sort of mandate as a partly state-funded institution. We tend to bucket them into three categories, if you like. There are, and I think this is what makes our sector distinct from, say, conventional pharmaceutical development. The three buckets are market development, manufacturing and process development, and clinical development. And there are challenges in all three. So from a market development point of view, these are therapeutics with curative intent. And that actually brings a whole pricing issue because it's about how people understand the value of a cure. But it also brings structural issues in terms of the budgets and the likes. And we do a lot of work in trying to prepare that market, if you like, globally, not just in the UK. On the clinical development front, you've got the same sort of things that you, I'm sure, are familiar with and have heard from other participants in your series about the implications of a curative therapy from a clinical development point of view. It has great benefits in that you can achieve statistical significance very, very quickly with about 30 patients or so sometimes. But that also brings with it some challenges because you get less information, actually. And from when you play that back to the reimbursement perspective, sometimes there isn't enough information to satisfy the people who are being asked to pay. So again, we work on those challenges and clinical design processes that try and get as much information out of what you're trying to do as possible. And then on the manufacturing front, we work at all levels. So we work at the biology level, if you like, what happens inside the bag in very simple terms or inside the manufacturing vessel. We work at the in-room setup level in terms of what kinds of equipment to use, optimizing equipment, how to make that equipment to work together in close processes. And then we work at the how to optimize the room, how to get as many processes into the room as possible, if you like. And then we work at the super scale, which is how do you get all the supply chains to feed that room in and out to make sure that manufacturing is optimized. And these are all challenges that are ongoing for the industry as it grows.
For sure. I found it interesting something you said earlier, and you know, some of those clinical development services in particular sound a little bit like CDMO work that would the private sector would conduct in lots of places. It seems to me it might be difficult to continue to be able to draw the line between what's in scope and what's out of scope and not stray into things that the private sector might do well or might want to do, and still stay true to your remit. How do you strike that balance? And is it a constant thing?
It's a constant thing, and it's a real challenge. It's what makes the Catapult so exciting, but it's also what makes it very difficult as well sometimes, because we're looking for the challenges. So we're looking for things that haven't been solved. Yes. We go out and try and solve them. And frankly, the moment that the industry picks them up in some way, shape, or form, we back away. If the industry's starting to run with it, we move on to the next challenge. Right. So we, for instance, in terms of, you know, suggested that some of the clinical work might be now possible to get service providers from the private sector. 10 years ago, you couldn't. We approached the CROs and said, you should look at this industry. It's going to be exciting. And they just looked at us and said, what? yes. Now, of course, everybody's a world expert in the space. And so we've backed out of that space. We don't provide CRO services or anything in there. Where we do come in is some of the advanced regulatory interface, for instance, where the regulators, and we work as an interface between the industry and the regulators to think about what new legislation looks like, what new regulation could look like down the road in order to facilitate the growth of the industry.
No, that's great. It's something we're going to talk about later, but it's a good segue to it now, which is we've seen regulators in the UK and in the US specifically starting to think about new models of manufacturing, maybe moving away from the traditional large batch centralized model to ones that might be able to bring manufacturing closer to the patient. And I wonder what your thoughts are on this kind of, whether this is a good thing, a bad thing, not sure yet. You know, whether it's today, I think with today's technology, it's probably not even possible to do some of the things that we want to do, given the current state of affairs. But I wonder, you know, how our listeners in the industry should think about this challenge from your perspective. You know, what problems and challenges does this solve and or create for us?
I think this is one of the long-running questions, and it's also a very fascinating question. Of course, from my perspective, I think we're talking about autologous therapies primarily here in this context. I think when you get into allogeneic, there is a different dynamic. And I think autologous therapy has a long way to go, because I think it has some fantastic benefits that overweigh some of the challenges. But I don't think it's just a near patient and centralized manufacturing question. I think there are three manufacturing levels that have emerged within this space. I think there is centralized manufacturing. I think there is near patient manufacturing. And I think there's inpatient manufacturing.
Right.
And my own view is that all three will have a role in some way, shape, or form. And it will be driven, in this case, by the clinical data. Now, the reason I say in this case is because I've spent a lot of the last 10 years fighting the basic notion, and we'll possibly touch on this later, that it's all about the clinical results, because I don't think it is. I think there's a lot of product development involved in what we're doing here. But yes. In this case, I think it'll be the scale of the clinical effect and what manufacturing has in terms of the benefit to the patient that determines which one of those three is pursued by a particular product. As you say, it's a chicken and egg with near patient manufacturing at the moment, because the technology is not quite there yet for the regulators to fully engage with it. But the regulation's not quite there yet for the technology to be fully developed in order to be trialed. And that's one of the things where the Catapult comes into it. So we have spent a bit of time engaging with the MHRA in the UK and some of the things that you've seen come out with them about near patient manufacturing in the last couple of years are as a result of that, so that we're getting them to prepare the regulatory environment.
And I think it's massively useful, the work, the kind of groundwork you've done with the regulator who has at least signaled an interest in this, in, you know, the kind of, this makes sense to us. We don't know exactly how it gets done. You know, the MHRA put some guidance out last year that indicated this might be something they would consider in a kind of hub and spoke model, that not the traditional licensing an individual site to make an individual product, which is helpful. And then, you know, the FDA earlier this year, similar guidance around CAR T manufacturing to say, like, you know, there's an indication that the regulator will accept this. of course, without compromising on safety and quality, which is their major concern. And I would argue exactly right that that gives those of us in the sort of innovation side of the field the kind of green light to say, well, we can think a little bit differently. We don't have to necessarily fit into the box as it exists today. We can look to tomorrow and 3 years from now to maybe think about, you know, different elements that we could bring to the table. As I think you know, I can't remember the last conversation we had, but, you know, Ori is a cloud native platform. So it's an IoT, allows us to be able to monitor what's happening with the cell culture in real time from anywhere in the world, and allows us to tech transfer essentially at the push of a button if we're able to digitize and really get the platform to work. So those kinds of technologies, we definitely haven't solved all the problems. There's too many for one individual company to solve, but those kinds of technologies can help enable us to potentially get there. And we've had this conversation with the FDA and are trying to have it with the MHRA to say, well, this is kind of how we're thinking about it. Does that sound about right? You know, what are your additions? What else should we be thinking about? And they have definitely signaled an openness to think about this.
And I think what you're describing there, which you know, in the early days we used to reference the Rolls-Royce engines model or the GE engines model, where huge amount of data goes back. There's planes flying all over the world, but the data is going back to a central control point where somebody's looking at those engines and making sure that they're all running fine and intervening with, and that's got to be part of the future in terms of making near patient manufacturing economic, because it utilizes the advantage of digital technology.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, even those advancements in thinking around business model as well, you know, as, you know, if you can have, I think, you know, the analogy that I've heard drawn in the past is, you know, essentially people pay for uptime. You know, if the engine's up and working and the plane's in the air, then that's what they pay for, and not all the other stuff, which is, you know, brings some new thinking potentially to the technology side of advanced therapies. Since we're on digital, I was going to touch with you this with you later, but I think it's a great time to do it now. Most of the companies that we interact with and the service providers in the field are really still kind of facing this paper burden, this kind of, you know, paper batch records, lab notebooks, data being collected. Maybe if it's digital, it might be in a spreadsheet and it might be in an on-prem database, but very difficult to try and aggregate that data, structure it, and make any sense out of it. It sort of is there for quality purposes or batch release purposes, but it's difficult to really learn and garner information and insights out of it. What are your thoughts on this kind of, you know, we sort of have a shorthand internally to say paper is the enemy of scale. Ultimately, one of your colleagues, Stephen Ward, who we know very well, has a horrific graph that sort of the need for QP resources goes exponential as you think about needing to batch release, you know, thousands and tens of thousands of autologous doses, because we need to do the same amount of rigor to release one product for one patient as we would for, you know, millions of tablets potentially in a small molecule. So how do you think about this issue, the importance of digital for the future that we hope to get to? And what, if anything, is the Catapult doing now to help us kind of move in that direction?
Sure. So from a Catapult perspective, digital is the future without question. We have to go that way. For the reasons that you and Stephen give. Where we are now is an interesting one in terms of the industry. And I'm probably going to be slightly controversial here. When I recall something that somebody once said to me about the internet and the cyber world, if you like, and they said, you know what, people like us, we're going to be visitors. We're going to be strangers, but visitors, intrigued visitors in the digital world. Our children are going to be natives of the digital world. And I think we're on that cusp at the moment as an industry. We still see people saying, well, I really want to sort it out on paper first of all and make it all work on paper. And then that's the easy way to translate the process into a digital process. And that's probably true for that group of people who have been working in paper. The future generations will not have that paper stage. They'll go straight through to the digital because they'll be working with different tools in different ways. And as a Catapult, we recognize that. Stephen's been a leader in this field. We recognize that very early on. We've had a couple of paper processes that we've put in place in order to get things done. Partly, you know, being pragmatic about where we were, but we're phasing them out very rapidly. as a sort of side note, I did see something fly across my emails today about, I think it's an indication where we are. Somebody sent a note across saying, do you realize that two of the printers in the office haven't been used for 3 months? which is an indication of the fact that actually as an organization, paper is disappearing.
Yes. No, it's great news. We're moving into a fully digital world. I would agree. And I think, I guess the challenge that we see, and I wonder if you see this as well, is there is a certain, let's say, linear process often in therapeutics development, going through the preclinical phase, the process discovery phase, as we call it. You know, how are we going to turn these often immune cells into a therapeutic? And we, you know, apply our knowledge and our special sauce to that. And then there's a real kind of urgency to get into the clinic so that we can become a clinical stage asset or company and to the value inflection that creates. But there's this sort of momentum where we have to reach that next stage gate every time. You know, there's always that next thing we have to do in a sense of urgency. And very rarely, and I've had, you know, an advisor of ours, Isabel Riviere, we did a podcast with her from Sloan Kettering, say something similar, to say that there's no time to stop and assess where you're at and say, okay, well, the process we're developing right now, maybe on paper, doesn't get us to scale, doesn't get us to be able to deliver a cost-effective product or deliver one that can treat more than 1 or 2% of the patient population. Because there's this sort of urgency and momentum in hitting the next milestone, the next stage gate, the next value inflection point. And so one of the things that, you know, actually my very first guest on the podcast, Anthony Davies, who no doubt you know from Dark Horse, and something that I've parroted quite a lot in various discussions, is we really have to address those challenges right away. You know, for those that end up digitally native, that never go onto paper, great, they're a step ahead. But those people who are operating in paper and or aren't addressing scalability from even preclinical are really running towards, you know, very fast towards the edge of a cliff and hoping that the bridge gets built before they drive off the side. And we've seen, unfortunately, a lot of companies struggle with comparability as they change their process fundamentally to make it more higher throughput, more reliable. That comparability that the regulator demands hasn't really been achieved for many companies, or they just stay with their clinical process and try and scale that out. And that has, you know, a considerable amount of challenges, not the least of which is often very high cost of goods, large facility investments. So I would argue that you're 100% right that there's a lot of people who want to do it on paper first, but we, let's say as enablers of the industry, need to do a better job in helping make it easy to start out at the endpoint, right? So let's start out at in a process that's digital, that's scalable, so that we can ultimately, you know, achieve our ends. Because I'm afraid that too many of these programs will run into that dead end eventually.
So I think, you know, that illustrates one of the reasons why the catapult exists, because it's very easy for us to talk about a digital world, right? But to really embrace it, you need access to it. And one of the things that we are trying to do with our large-scale manufacturing development and our process development side of things is to bring the digital world into a safe environment where people can come and experience it. So we have, and you know, it goes right the way down to process analytics and process control. If you think about the amount of data that's involved with that, and then the amount of data that's involved with real-time changing of processes over time, controlling those processes, which doesn't happen very often. And this is going beyond autologous into allogeneic and viral vector manufacturing. You need very sophisticated systems to control the processes that really don't exist today. And you certainly don't want to go out and build them for yourself. You want to go out and see them and experience them. And one of the things that we've done is try to create an environment where companies can come and experiment with it and get familiar with it, and therefore, and that's more likely to make it a safer decision to incorporate it into what they're doing.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. And as I said, I think for organizations like the Catapult and for Ori, making it easily experienced, making the benefits obvious, and a safe transition as much as it can be to really front run some of these issues is incumbent upon us, you know, to help really change that mindset. And I think one of my chief digital officer, a guy called Kevin Gordon, who I'm not sure if you had a chance to meet yet, has a very long history. He was involved with the very early days of Kite and Kite Connect and as a consultant, and then went to work for Tmunity Therapeutics, and one of the very first people to build a fully digital paperless manufacturing process. So they were doing QA and QC by exception, you know, batch release, continuous validation. And, you know, he speaks about how that was selling that internally was pretty difficult in the beginning, you know, with the quality team who's used to ticking things off on paper. But once they sort of got over that hump, they're like, well, this is magic. You know, this is a, you know, indelible record that can't be changed, that sort of demonstrates that if we ever, you know, need to demonstrate our process to the regulator, you know, and it's much more highly accurate in these things. So there's definitely benefits there. But, you know, as we know in healthcare, we're often laggards, unfortunately, in the adoption of technologies, usually for good reasons, because we're dealing with people's lives and we don't want to move too quickly. But we think, you know, when I just saw some recent data, I want to say last week, where really looking at the cell and gene therapy industry as a whole, there's something on the order of 2,700 clinical trials going on globally. And then they break them down by phase. I think 99% are phase two or earlier. Something like 83% were phase one or earlier. And then 60-odd% are preclinical. So we're still in, you know, the very early days of this industry. As you said, I think a lot of those preclinical phase one companies and trials will be digital native potentially, you know, if we can kind of bring these tools to market.
I really hope so. But there's, you know, we have, there's another group that we haven't brought into this conversation. We did earlier when we talked about near patient manufacturing, but the regulators, we need to bring them with us too, in terms of the skill sets that need to be present, because validating a digital process is very different from validating a paper process. It's a different sort of, like you talked about, you know, QC by exception. And certainly the MHRA in the UK, I think, is a mine of talent. But what we've got to do is work with them so that when it comes to us bringing products to them and saying, you know, this is all digital, that they're ready for that. You know, we did that with NICE in the UK and CAR-Ts. We started with them 5 years ahead of the first product being available and saying, this is coming. Mm. Just think about what you're going to have to do to the hospital system, what you're going to have to do to the payment system, how you're going to even evaluate it. Because that's really important for the development of the industry.
100%. I'd like to come back to that actually topic. Because I think one of the lessons from the pandemic, and I've, you know, sat on a couple of discussions on this, one of the things that I think the UK did right and generally regulators did right, there was a huge amount of regulatory innovation to get those, you know, life-saving vaccines to patients quickly. And, you know, similarly, I think certainly the regulators in the advanced therapies field have had, you know, new ways of thinking. They brought new ways of thinking to maybe combine phase one, two, which we hadn't ever seen before, or smaller trials. These are often very sick patients that are at the end of the road. So that regulatory innovation has been there and needs to continue to be there, as you said. And you know, we've spoken to the FDA and CBER about the platform that we're bringing to the market and are looking to have the same conversation with the MHRA so that we can align our points of view and really understand where their heads are at so that we can, you know, make sure that we're not too far ahead or too far to the left or too far to the right from where they think we should be traveling.
I hope when you do that, you have the experience that we had when we went into them, actually it's probably near 8 years ago now, with saying CAR-Ts were on their way. And we were prepared to be thrown out. We thought they were going to turn around and say, look, we haven't got time to deal with this right now. Right. It was quite the opposite. They were like, this sounds fantastic. It sounds like part of the future. How do we work with you to learn more? And I hope you have that same experience.
Yes. Yeah. Our hope is that we'll get in shortly with the MHRA. It was just that with the FDA. We actually walked into the room and Peter Marks was there and Celia Whitten, his deputy. There was a room full of CBER team from all over the different functional areas, very keen to hear about the technology. And I think, you know, as you will well know, the regulators are equally frustrated with, they see these incredible therapies that have curative potential and they see them unable to assist as many patients as anyone would like, you know, them included. So I think they're very open to these kinds of things. Of course, again, never compromising on safety or quality, but they've shown, I think, an unprecedented willingness to be open and to think about, you know, innovation alongside the rest of us. So hopefully we'll have that discussion with the MHRA soon. Speaking of innovation, I think we've been working with the Catapult for a long time. I think actually Farland's when we made the very first Ori device, they shipped it directly from the prototype house to the
Capitol. I remember that box coming into the facility.
For testing, which was a very high-risk strategy, which ultimately paid off for him. Thankfully.
Well, we were very excited. We thought it was great.
No, exactly. And you know, we've enjoyed a good partnership since then, of course. And I wonder, in your seat as the CEO of the Catapult, you must see all kinds of interesting innovations around the industry. And I wonder, kind of a two-part question. One is, where do you think the need for innovation is most acute? You know, where should innovators out there be thinking and targeting their efforts? As you know, what are the low-hanging fruit, if you will? And then, what out there have you seen that really gets you and your team excited? What are the things that, you know, either that are here now or that are in the short-term horizon that you're really excited about?
So remember, we are cell and gene therapy geeks, so we like the detail. But the you know, part of our vision is to see advanced therapies, an industry in the UK that's delivering advanced therapies to the world. Now, there's a lot in that, because it's not just about a UK solution, it's about a global product, but it's also about moving out into wider indications, more prevalent indications. And that's the trend that I think we're just starting to see picking up. And that's very exciting. Yes. Because I think that brings democratization, if you like, of this curative therapy or class of curative therapies. But it also brings massive challenges, because you've got challenges in the biology. Let's not forget that our industry is picking up from research, the research base, technologies faster than anything else I've ever seen. You know, the moment something happens within the research base, our industry picks it up and starts running with it. But it also means we're depending on it as well, because that's feeding our growth. And so we need the biology to keep going now. We need the understanding of the biology of cells and the control of cells and the implication of genes and gene therapies inside the body as well as in cells outside of the body. We need all of that to move. We also then need scale manufacturing. You know, if you're going to go into more prevalent indications, you take the manufacturing challenge we talked about before and increase it by a log order or two. So you're then into, how do you produce vast volumes of a gene therapy to meet a market need in be it diabetes or neurodegenerative diseases or all sorts of things. And then that comes back to what some of the things we've been talking about, you know, process analytics and control. How do you actually control these large processes? And how do you stay close to the real time from a digital perspective, so that if something starts to move off, hopefully the process itself adjusts. But if it doesn't, you can intervene very, very quickly. You cannot afford to lose a 3,000 liter batch. And, you know, I think it comes back to the Catapult role from what I'm saying here. You know, there's a huge gap there in terms of manufacturing technologies and the scale train, if you like. You know, we can work a continuous scale up process from 15 milliliters all the way up to 3,000 liters potentially. But everybody's got to start thinking about that and working on it and developing it. So I think it's, you know, the excitement coming forward, I think, is more indications and larger scale. But the cost has to come down with it. You know, you know, as you move into those more prevalent indications, you've got to be able to treat at lower cost.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, I think the shorthand, when people ask me, what is Ori trying to do? We're trying to make these therapies widely available at a higher throughput, higher quality, and lower cost. And that really ultimately is the kind of triumvirate of what needs to happen.
I think we share a set of common goals there.
We do indeed. You know, we do indeed. And I think, you know, I would echo your sentiments around, and I have done on the podcast previously, but I don't think it hurts banging the drum again to say, it's really the kind of analytics where I see the biggest gap. It's, how do we see inside the process so that we can understand what's happening at a, you know, real core root level and be able to adapt. You know, our hope is that we're using, you know, inline sensing capability that allows us to capture data but only the very sort of tip of the iceberg. There's so many other things we'd like to be able to know, to incorporate into the system. We looked at every single, you know, commercially available sensor technology out there. And there just wasn't that much. There wasn't that much that really was reliable enough or, you know, yielded the right kinds of information that we could then, you know, capture in real time and structure and aggregate and deliver insights from. It's really an area where, you know, computer vision, you know, being able to look at cells and tell what's happening with them and or count them, that would be awesome. You know, how do you work that inside of a bioreactor where it's 37 degrees and it's a moist environment? You know, there's all these sort of engineering challenges, but it can no doubt be solved. I think if the demand is there for greater insights into the, you know, real time in the process and what's happening. And that's a major gap from my perspective.
And I think the excitement from our perspective is that this is a common problem. This is a problem for the industry. And when we put our hand up a couple of years ago and said, we think this is such a big problem that individual companies will not solve it by themselves. We need to work together on this to understand, first of all, the scientific process of developing new analytics and then turning analytical data into information that's then used for control. And that in itself will inform new types of sensor and what kind of demand there is for sensor. We put together a consortium, and the demand for participation in that consortium has just been awesome. And we're now, we've got 20 companies working together, developing the science of analytics and control, which I think is tremendously exciting. And it's good for the industry because it's going to move us to the next level of scale.
Yeah, 100%. Well, Ori is a member of that consortium, as you know, and apologies for stealing Steven Shopka, who put that together, who now works at Ori. But I think one of the roles that you didn't highlight yet is, you know, obviously the Catapult is one of the, you know, best training grounds for talent that goes, you know, does great work for the industry and then, you know, sometimes goes out and works directly for industry. But that is certainly one of your remits, as I understand it, is really to cultivate that next generation of the talent pool to feed the industry. Maybe you could just tell us a little bit about that piece of the Catapult puzzle.
Sure. I mean, it's when we set off in the, 10 years ago, we hired from the industry. You know, we said, because we had no option. We didn't have any, you know, we went out there and tried to hire from actually, there wasn't that much of an industry at that time. But about 3 or 4 years ago, we realized that this wasn't sustainable anymore because the industry had turned on us. The industry was turning to us and saying, how, you know, where do we find good people who've had broad experience and know how to work? And so they came and started enticing people away from us, shall we say, which we decided to turn into a positive and so what we do is we go out to recruit people and offer them, as you say, diverse experience, really good training, and an enjoyable environment to work in. And they come and we turn them into feedstock for the growth of the industry. So that's the role that we play. We have to keep it at a sustainable level, and we can't supply the thousands and thousands of people that the industry needs. But it's an important role. The other thing that we have done is we've set up a series of different lines of training and development to bring talent into the industry. So we set up the world's first apprenticeship program in the cell and gene therapy space, which is one of my favorite parts, one of our favorite achievements, if you like, because it's opened up the world of cell and gene therapy, this fantastic 50-year career, if you want to work that long, to school leavers and to other generations. Yes. You know, there are people in the apprenticeship program who are graduates as well. So that's been brilliant. That's brought a new kind of talent in and recognizing that not everybody has to be a PhD to work in our industry. We've got 4 training centers that we coordinate. They're existing training facilities or groups who are putting through cohorts appropriate to the demand of the industry. So everything from regulatory to clean room use, if you like. And then the last strand that I will talk about is the online resources that we've created. One of them is an AI engine, which takes people from other industries, allows them to put their history into a search engine and be told where they might fit into our industry so that they can start focusing. So we've brought people from the forensics world into the cell and gene therapy space, which now looks obvious because it's all about data and analytics. We've brought bakers into the cell and gene therapy world because they work with processes and controls. Yeah, and so everything to try and bring people into the industry, because we can see, you know, we predicted a growth in the industry and it happened earlier than we even predicted it. And now we're predicting the industry in the UK and globally doubling again in terms of employment. And that needs a lot of talent.
I think we're 3 or 4 years ahead of where we'd thought be for the demand for talent, isn't it? And I think maybe it was 10,000 in 2025 and we're at 8,000 now or something. I'm getting the numbers wrong, but it's something of that order of magnitude. Yeah. And I had, we have had the pleasure of having interns from Kasim Rafiq's program at UCL, where they've started a master's in cell and gene therapy program. I think it directly to address, it's actually a master's in cell and gene therapy manufacturing. It's that specific, and have had great talent come out of there. And you know, the efforts of the Catapult are greatly appreciated by the industry, because I think we realize that it's all that kind of human resource, that human talent, that's going to make the difference over time. And they're just not enough of that, of those talented people yet available. So, you know, I always say, I don't know if any high schoolers or secondary school students are listening to the podcast. I doubt it, but if they are, definitely this is an area to focus on, the, you know, biochemical engineering, data science, some of these process analytics, amazing and incredible and very interesting careers ahead.
I don't know if you've ever gone out to a school and given a talk, but you know, it's I've done it a couple of times, and we are starting a program of extension to try and entice people to come into the industry. But you know what? It's an easy sell. You go out and then you talk about what we do. We create therapeutics that transform people's lives, curative therapeutics, and we're working at the leading edge of technology. And people just ask where to sign up. It's just a brilliant experience.
Yeah. A brief anecdote that's not really relevant, but maybe indicative of what you're saying, is I was having dinner in Cambridge a week or two ago, and we were talking about what Ori does, and the server was sort of looking at me, and she's like, you know, listening and trying not to be obtrusive. And at one point she stopped and she's like, I just did my, you know, I was just studying for my A-levels and covering this topic in biology. And she was a secondary student. It just, you know, I think that the interest is there, and being able for people to sort of understand this opportunity early so that they can direct their careers in this way. Is critical. And so that they're going to get you out on the roadshow to schools all over the UK, because I think it's a great effort that needs to be done.
I think globally, I think we need the whole world working in it.
Absolutely, absolutely. Well, we're coming close to the end of our time together. There's a couple more questions I was hoping to address before we depart. One was really around the sort of biggest changes that you've seen in the industry since you've been involved over the last few years, in particular, the kind of mindset shifts that have happened. I mean, the UK government has been, I think, very proactive in their support of advanced therapies and trying to cultivate this as one of the, you know, pillars of the industrial strategy and one of the ways to drive economic growth in the UK in the future. What changes, if any, have you seen that will be most impactful to the mindsets, either at the policy level or in the kind of industry level? And which ones still do you think need to be worked on? Is there anything that you think we could focus on?
So, you know, you go back 10 years, there wasn't much of an industry. It was really focused on the scientific endeavor, you know, showing that these things worked. And I think the biggest change that I have seen, and I like to think the Catapult's played a role in this, is people are now developing products. They're developing products for markets that are going to treat patients around the world. And that is a completely different mindset. It's not just about the science. It's about the three legs that we talked about before: the economic development, the clinical development, and the manufacturing and process and company development. So I think that's now we've got a serious industry that's doing product development, and that's great to see. Where do I think that I'd like to see better development? And this is a personal challenge, because I'm a little bit of me as an economist. I don't think as an industry we have got the message across to the decision makers about the huge potential of cell and gene therapy and some of the related technologies to transform healthcare. When you start with curative intent instead of treatment intent, it's a complete revolution in healthcare. You take something like a gene therapy in hemophilia, where a patient is treated for the whole duration of their life and a $12, $13 million cost. And you come along with something that says it's going to cost $3 million, but we're going to take all the rest of that cost away, or most of the rest of that cost away. Mm-hmm. And then you won't need the hospitals that they used to come in for referrals every 6 months and everything like that. The decision makers have not got that message yet. They don't fully understand it. And I think that's our fault as an industry. I think we can do a much, much better job of getting a full understanding of the potential and power that is yet to come from cell and gene therapies.
Yeah. No, I couldn't agree more. I think the way I sort of talk about this issue often is, you know, we've proven the clinical and scientific case for advanced therapies. We know they work. We know we can create curative therapies. We haven't yet proven the commercial case, like how do the economics work? And, you know, that is incumbent upon, again, companies like Ori to help improve the economics. So, you know, our goal is to have the cost of goods for manufacturing a CAR T therapy, for example, at launch, you know, late next year, early 2024, we hope to be able to cut that cost dramatically. What today is $150,000 a patient to $200,000 a patient just to make the product. You know, then they would go on to charge, you know, whatever it is, $500,000. If we can cut the cost of goods dramatically, first by 50%, but ultimately by 90%, and then we are able to give therapy developers much more flexibility in the way they contract and the way they price products. These are very clinically effective and will probably even be even more effective first or second line. You have healthier cells, healthier patients. So we're almost in the worst of all worlds today, which is we're taking the sickest patients at the latest stage of their disease progression and still having great clinical results. Once they've already spent all that money that you referenced, you know, I'm speaking, you know, maybe about oncology specifically here, but, you know, if we're able to, I think people sort of say to me, well, you're crazy to think these could ever be first line. I say, well, actually, if you add up all the costs of multiple rounds of chemo, hospital visits, tests, you know, a transplant at second line, maybe, you know, stem cell or bone marrow, you go down the list, it's quite a large cost to the system. And you might be able to make the case for, you know, our hope is that they're dramatically cheaper than they are today. But even at, you know, even let's say 100,000 or two, I mean, who knows, 200,000, it might be cost effective given all the other costs associated with managing those patients in the system. But I think you're right. It's very difficult to make that sort of long-term cost savings argument to payers, you know, especially in a US context where the average covered life stays with a health plan for less than 3 years. So I'll be paying for something that, you know, some other health plan somewhere will benefit. But if you think about it as an entire risk pool, as long as everyone's sort of addressing those patients as they trade those lives around the health plan, it can work. And within the NHS context, it's an obvious potential win, specifically for diseases like the one you mentioned, you know, hemophilia and others that cause, you know, that are, you know, chronic and take long-term management. So it's a complicated chicken and the egg here of, you know, we've got expensive products that, you know, we need to be able to manufacture more effectively, make more widely available, make accessible. And then we can demonstrate even higher clinical benefit, potentially, ultimately lower costs.
And I think that's where I would really like to see a difference, because this is a technology cycle. Okay, you start with expensive products, you get early adopters, you then get volume adoption, you get competition, prices come down, and Ori is playing a fundamental role in enabling competition by making competition possible from an economic point of view. What we really need to see as well is action and a realization that it is a technology adoption cycle, and action by the payers to facilitate the adoption of the technology. The volumes will enable the drive down of price, and that's why I think I have a challenge, or we as the Catapult have a challenge to educate the payers.
Well, and referencing back, you know, one of the things that I also said in some of those panel discussions about the learnings from the pandemic, you know, having a vaccine in this case that was guaranteed to be paid for. There was a contract. They said, we'll buy X number of units, millions or billions or whatever the numbers were, at this price. If you can produce it, we'll buy it. Now, maybe that model doesn't work for every therapeutic out there in the world, but if you think about, if there's economic certainty that you'll get access, you'll get coverage at a price that I can work towards making it cost-effective for me as a therapy developer to develop a product and sell it at that price, that's a way to think about it as well. We've seen, the sort of worst case scenario, which is you get, a product like Zynteglo, which is clinically effective, offered to patients in Europe, but unable to be accessed for various reasons. There's been no published reason as to why it was. I heard that there was I think they were asking $1.6 or $1.8 million per patient, and couldn't come to an agreement with payers in Europe at that price, and so decided that they couldn't affordably offer it. Now, that's bad for the therapy developers who spent all that money and all that time developing it. That's terrible for patients. It's bad for health systems. That's the kind of outcome we have to avoid. We need to find a way to front run that so that those markets, supply and demand can meet at a certain price. And being able to telegraph, this is the demand, this is where the demand is, the price that the demand is there, could be one way. Again, I'm not a pricing expert, but
supply and demand and competition.
Yes, exactly. We're in the early days, and as you have multiple suppliers, potentially that gets better, and technologies that can help. So we have to do our part, no doubt. So one last question before I let you go, if you don't mind. I'll ask you to kind of dust off your crystal ball, which you have under your desk there somewhere, I'm sure, to help me predict the future for the industry in the kind of 5 to 10 year time frame. What do you see? What things will we have done well? What successes we have had, and what challenges will still be ahead of us?
So I see a thriving industry without any question at all. I see increased levels of adoption. I do see that the cost of the therapeutics dropping quite dramatically as organizations like both of our organizations contribute towards technologies that bring down cost. And I see the beginnings, if you're only limiting me to a 5 year time frame, I see the beginnings of higher levels of adoption, which will drive the competition that we talked about before. I also see much more investment in the higher prevalence therapy areas, and that will be driving a very positive interaction, as we talked about before, between investment, the research sector, and the pull on the research sector for new biological information, and bringing down the cost and increasing the relevance of this sector for the payers and the decision makers at the government level. I think it's a very positive environment that we're going into.
Yeah. And maybe those kinds of things, the type 1 diabetes or the cardiovascular disease, where you see this incredible work happening. It might be one of those where you have a relatively defined population. You sort of know who they are, where they are. You know the relative costs of managing them. This might be where, creative contracting or these kinds of agreements might come into place. You say, well, actually, we can address your whole population with a gene therapy or some other intervention. And it'll cost you X, and then you'll have gotten over the hump on those costs. And that might be a way in which we see some of that innovation reach patients at scale. And so really looking forward to seeing some of that innovation and being part of the next wave of the industry as we progress. Just wanted to say thank you so much for spending your time with us today. It's been fantastic and really enjoyed the conversation. And can't wait to see you hopefully again in three dimensions next time instead of two.
Well, thank you very much. I really enjoyed the conversation too. And look forward to meeting face to face.
Thank you for listening to the Ori Spotlight Podcast. To keep up with the latest in cell and gene therapy, and to follow us on our mission to manufacture brighter futures for patients, head to the show notes to follow us on social media or visit OriBiotech.com.